Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the Church today. The body in the theology of Martin Luther is the topic of today's show with your host, Pastor John Ehlers.
Hello and welcome to The Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm John Ehlers, your host, and I'm pastor of Christ Lutheran Church, located in Orpington, Kent, which is a southeastern suburb of London. I'd like to encourage you to come along and join us for worship every Sunday morning at 10:30. And if you don't live in our area, then please, by all means, go to our website, lutheran.co.uk. Click on the directory to find the nearest Lutheran church to where you live. We'd also like to take this opportunity to thank you for all of your prayers and for your generous financial contributions. For these help keep Lutheran Radio on the air, and we deeply appreciate them and give thanks to God for your kindness, your support, and your generosity. Today we're very excited to welcome Dr. Charles Courtwright. He's an associate professor of theology at Wisconsin Lutheran College in Milwaukee, Wisconsin in the USA. Dr. Courtwright did his PhD work at Marquette University, where his dissertation was on This Bag of Maggots, Luther's Theology on the Human Body. His dissertation will be appearing in the near future in a series commemorating the upcoming 500th anniversary of the posting of the 95 Theses. So we encourage you to keep your eye out for this very interesting book, which will be hitting our shelves in the next few years. We'd like to welcome Dr. Courtwright, who will be talking to us on this topic, Luther's Theology of the Human Body. Dr. Courtwright, welcome to Lutheran Radio UK.
Thank you very much.
Now, my first question might be, why even worry about Luther's theology and understanding of the body?
Well, in some ways, I would suspect if we could conjure up Martin Luther, have him in front of us, he'd say, I don't understand why you're so curious about my view either. It really comes from a, I'd say, 20th century, 21st century concerns about the body and our own views and questions about the body that makes this an interesting topic. But Luther himself, of course, I would call him a late medieval man, and in that theologian, and in that regard, he held to a fairly conservative point of view regarding the human body that is quite different in some respects from what moderns look at. So some of the questions that we would like to ask, I think he'd be genuinely puzzled by, and would rather talk about many other things that the body is just adjunct to. But we're interested in what he has to say, and so that's where the interest of the research and the conclusions really come down.
Now, within the world and the context that Luther existed in, there were some competing understandings and views of the body. Is that correct? Like the Platonic view.
He is the heir to a long discourse in the church, both East and West, but primarily I'm concerned with the Western Church. That changes over time, just as many other views in theology changed, so that understandings become sharpened and develop. And he stands then at the end of this kind of process, at least as far as our examination of the 16th century is concerned. And so shares a number of things that are kind of bubbling below him, that have been examined or have come to the fore or have been of interest and importance to Western Christianity for some time. It starts out, of course, with what we would call Platonic dualism way back in the time of the early church. But by the time we come to Luther, we need to remember that the philosopher Aristotle, of course, has been rediscovered or reintroduced into the West, and his introduction of his worldview, as that gets taken up and is utilized by the high scholastics of the 13th century in particular, does change the way that theology is going to be talking about the body. Luther, when I mentioned at the beginning that Luther would be kind of maybe curious about why our interest in the body, held to the point of view that the human person, of course, is not just body or soul, but body and soul. And theologically, we still teach this. But we live on the other side of what I would call the Cartesian divide. And so it's very easy for us to think of, you know, me or my mind or my inner person as distinct from my body. Luther, I don't think, could ever think in those terms. And that's really a result of that long process of understanding the body as integral to the human person that he would speak of. We also have to throw into the mix the fact that by the late 1400s, Europe, of course, has been engulfed by the plague and other illnesses that make death a very, very prime matter of concern and focus in the late medieval society. And so while scholasticism starts to become hardened and scholarized by its ends and really becomes quite disconnected from the common person in the street, at the same time, mystic preaching and a desire to get beyond the body because of the problems of life and the shortness of it, the unsurety of it, also influences then some of the discussion, discourse, and views of the body that we see bubbling up in the 1400s as Luther is born then begins to do his work in the early 1500s.
So let's talk about Luther then and his understanding of the body. We know that he was an Old Testament scholar and did a lot of work in the book of Genesis. Can we learn anything from his numerous lectures on the book of Genesis about his understanding of the body?
Yes, we certainly can. In fact, part of my main research was looking at how he developed. He actually had three opportunities that we believe to discuss in a formal setting his views of the body, the earliest coming in his early career, and is rather truncated. I mean, he's still following by that point the traditional manner of exegesis and explanation of the text. But nonetheless, we start to see certain themes that are carried through all the way to his great Genesis lectures, which dominate the last decade of his life. In that regard, Luther certainly upholds the good creation of the body, both male and female. And this is of interest to us in that sometimes Luther, of course, gets pinned with the title of being misogynistic. He can be somewhat ambiguous when it comes to talking about Eve. But in the main, we would see him discussing Eve and the women in Genesis in particular in very high glowing terms. He after all calls Sarah the most holy matriarch of the Jewish people, for example. And with that then, we see him viewing male and female, the creation of male and female, certainly as God's good creation. And the body in that regard is something that is not evil, not to be shunned, not to be considered wicked or something of that nature, but in its creation to be God's great gift, along with the soul, so human person, and to be celebrated then in appropriate ways in marriage, between husbands and wives, between men and women. And this is a much more, I believe, positive view of the body than many of his peers would have exhibited. This is also interesting in that, you have one voice of Luther in the lecture hall where he is talking to a male student body. And then, of course, you have his interactions at home that we can trace through the table talks where we have a very large, in terms of her presence, Katie von Bora, Katie Luther. And it's interesting to watch, in fact, through the letters and informal discussions that we see there, Luther's much more relaxed, I would say, and less even traditional points of view coming out as he interacts with Katie at home.
Now, you mentioned the gender differences or distinctions that Luther maintained in the lecture hall and perhaps a little less strenuously at home. Can you tell us a little bit more about those? And did he view them as different before the fall and after the fall? Or are they roughly the same?
Luther's presentation of the human before the fall, obviously, he sees this again as God's good creation and perfection. In fact, in the Genesis lectures, he can get kind of carried away sometimes as he rhapsodizes over the native powers of the body that was created for Adam and for Eve. He will say that he will claim that Adam possibly could have seen, you know, 100 miles with his eyesight better than any eagle, that he would have been able to handle lions and bears and tigers like puppies and all this kind of thing. So he has a very high view of the original creation. Obviously, the fall has changed that drastically, and he will excoriate that fall, the results of the fall in terms of the sinful nature, and as that also has to do with sexuality. He certainly is foursquare against sexual sins of any type. But within marriage, he sees this as he still sees the body as God's good creation after the fall, and that men and women are properly joined together in marriage sexually also. His viewpoints towards the relationship between the genders, I suppose people would say, would be patriarchal. But he's reflecting just this general society of the time, I would suggest. It's interesting in that while he maintains that, and you'll hear that very strongly in the voice that comes through the lectures, again, in the to a male audience, at home, while he still maintains himself as the patriarch of the family, so to speak, there is a genuine respect for the role of his wife and the role of women in general that argues against this kind of misogynism that sometimes the medievals in general and Luther in particular or other of the reformers might have. Adjunct to this, I think, of course, is the matter of marriage itself, which is undergoing great changes here in the 16th century. As Luther is brought to see the travesties, I guess we could call them, of the medieval monastic system and the false claims that it had about perfection of the person and sanctity, etc. He, on the other hand, is raising up marriage at that point, and so is very, very keen on extolling the institution, both before he participates in it in his marriage and in his marriage. And as a result, then, the role of the woman is also going to be upheld in a much different way than earlier medieval society. He certainly sees her as in her sphere, in the sphere of the house, as a someone who has been given the gifts and the abilities to serve God through her marriage, through her her being mother, through her work as the manager even of the household. While over it all, of course, it's the papa who has his role. But within the context, I think Luther is actually quite, we would say, enlightened from the standpoint of the role of the woman and the role of the man.
And do you think that enlightenment came from his marriage?
I think some realities came from his marriage. He he writes very frankly about it. He says it's a very strange thing. You wake up one morning suddenly and there are pigtails lying next to you in the bed. And he talks about in both a playful way, but also in very tender ways about the effects of marriage that he's had. He says that he would not trade Katy, for example, for Venice or for France itself. He thought so highly of her. And I remember also coming across some of his letters. Unfortunately, we don't have many of Katy's letters to Martin that have survived, but we do have a number of Martin's to Katy. And there you have this very poignant and loving relationship, somewhat playful. I think Luther, like his father, was kind of a joker in certain ways with his wife. But at the same time, one that genuinely appreciates and holds her high. Another interesting little facet in the relationship, for that matter, is, of course, in terms of their respective social standing, Luther was actually, of course, outranked by Katy because Katy was minor nobility. And at the same time, since he's the father of the household, and the head of the household, he will, you know, he appropriates that understanding to the relationship. But you can catch him sometimes kind of tweaking her nose, so to speak, with her calling her my grace and these other kinds of minor nobility titles, almost kind of jabbing at her. Yeah, I remember you're higher than me in terms of our social status, and yet then returning to the father and of the household relationship with her. The letters are delightful, in fact, some of the letters, and very touching. I have one here in front of me where he's addressing her in late in life. This is, in fact, a letter that comes not too far from his death, but in 1546, but he greets her this way: "To my dearly beloved Hausfrau, Katharina Luther, doctor, mistress of Zollstorf and the pig market, and whatever in addition she may be," giving her all these titles that really are meant to be joking in one sense, but actually complimentary, because he realized how valuable service she rendered to him, certainly personally, as the mother of their children, and to the well-being of the family. Luther had great confidence and great joy and respect for her as a result, and I think transfers that experience in general to women.
Now, with regard to their marriage and his understanding of the human body, how does sex fit into that? Again, in that society, in the Catholic Church, the monasteries, the nunneries, the priesthood, we're all supposed to be celibate, and we sort of get the feeling they viewed sex as something dirty, something not quite as spiritual as celibacy. But what were Luther's views on this subject?
Well, they do change, obviously. I mean, he starts out as an Augustinian friar himself, having taken vows of celibacy. And there's no reason to think that Luther was not actually quite successful in terms of maintaining chastity within his vows. Although the medieval notion was that the nuns, or and the monks for that matter, should be able to be completely free of natural sexual desires and so forth, and that the cowl, the monk's habit, actually protected him from these kinds of things. Therefore, women to men, to monastic men, would be seen as kind of the enemy. And you're absolutely right that sexuality was seen then as something debasing. The very sex act, I guess we'd have to say, was seen as almost an insanity, that the person is so out of control, in ecstasy, that this is not trusted in accord with scholastic theology. And so you'll hear that kind of language. You can find outright misogynistic language, too, in the case of some of the writings of the monks. And I don't know anything about the female side in regard to writing that way, but some of the earlier voices in monasticism, thinking of a woman as promiscuous and there to be a trap for the man. Luther then has to migrate from those kinds of points of view to the high view of his wife and of women in general that we mentioned. And this comes through first an honest appraisal of the monastic lie, I guess I'd have to call it, that a man or a woman is capable of that kind of chastity as blithely or as commonly as monasticism in the medieval period pretended it to be. Luther himself says that one person in a thousand may have the gift of true chastity, or celibacy, rather. And so he doubts very much, you know, how many of the monks and nuns in his age are really able to maintain the kind of purity of life and vows in not just outward actions, but especially in their thoughts and in their desires. So this sets up, of course, a large part of his discussion in the late 15-teens and early 1520s, as he takes on the monastic vow and plays it out according to the theology that he is increasingly seeing, that we're not saved by what we do. There's no greater sanctity to the monastic lifestyle than there is to the so-called secular lifestyle. And with that void then that's created by in his mind and in his theology that monasticism is taken out of the picture, marriage is going to be replacing that, because this is the common estate for most people, and deservedly so. It's the one that he'll reach back to Genesis, obviously, and say, this is what God created man and woman for, both in terms of the institution of marriage, but in their bodies. And as a result, within the confines of marriage, he sees sexuality as God's good creation. He is a realist. He realizes, and he will talk about the fact that just as sin infects all aspects of human life after the fall, so also within sexuality, husbands and wives do sin within their sexual lives. And I'm not talking about reaching outside the marriage, but where selfishness or where using the other person might be indicated in this regard. But overall, he is very high, he thinks very highly of the gift of sexuality. He's not grimly negative, as I found one correspondent or one writer regarding him called him. He's realistic. He realizes that human beings sin in any context, and so also within the sexual act, sin can be involved. But it's not some kind of it's not dirty. It's not something that he says, well, it's just something we have to endure or anything of that nature.
And I do find, I think, that most moderns do not view folks in the medieval times as talking about these subjects. But if you actually read Luther, I mean, he is very earthy. He is very, in many respects, graphic in his descriptions of the body and bodily functions, including sexuality.
Absolutely. Luther can be disarming in both a positive and a negative way. He will talk about sexuality in some very frank terms. It's never I won't say never. He can become somewhat bawdy, but in keeping with the standards of the time. But never gratuitously so, I don't think. He's never just using or talking about sexuality or sex in ways that it's just to be titillating or any of that kind of thing, which is what moderns, I think, we prattle on over and over about these things as though being able to talk about them is the most important thing in our lives. Luther faces the subject forthrightly, I think, in the way that he does practically everything. Sometimes he may overstate his case at certain points, or belabor it sometimes. I'm thinking of the Genesis lectures going on and on and on sometimes about certain aspects of Eve or of other couples within the Genesis narratives. But it's never without purpose, and it's never without a remembrance, it seems to me, reaching back to the beginning of Genesis. This is God's good creation, and even with the fall, men and women still are redeemed children of God, and participate then in the institution of marriage in holy ways, also as they join their flesh.
So Luther then could see our bodies, our physical bodies, as being very good, unlike, say, some of the Platonists. Luther saw them as being good as well as our spirit, and to separate the two was really a no-no.
Absolutely. He wouldn't even countenance that idea, I don't believe. He's no Manichaean. That's how I would describe him. He certainly does not play to the body in the sense that, the body is everything. He realizes it's under the subject, and it's under the subject of sin. It's going to die. It's a weak body. The title of the dissertation it picks up his phrase, the maggot sack, which is an interesting statement of his, which kind of captures, in fact, both the pathos but also the glory of the body in God's plan. Luther sees the body certainly as subject to illness. He himself had so many illnesses. He learns from that. His pastoral work is enhanced, in fact, by his own personal suffering and a certain and a real sense of a shared weakness with other human beings, that we're subject to so many frailties and limitations of the body. At the same time, his great hope is in the resurrection of the body. And so he celebrates it in terms of God's future plan, which is so appropriate right now during this time of the year, that one of the most interesting episodes, in fact, that I had a chance to look at very carefully is the death of his father Hans and also the death of his daughter Magdalena. And we see here, as Luther treats with those or deals with those deaths, how deeply he felt about them. He has a real poignant scene there at the deathbed of Magdalena Luther, for example. And yet at the same time, Luther, you know, they have to bury her the same day that she died, but at the graveside he cries out, there is a resurrection of the flesh. And this is his great hope. And it's vested in this promise of God that I, in my flesh, will see God, as Job says. And so he celebrates the body appropriately while remembering this side of heaven. The body is subject to all sorts of limitations and weaknesses and frailties.
The examination of the body in Luther's theology will continue next week. Thank you for listening to the Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.